Now, Kafka Connect is awesome, but in the end, it's nothing without its connectors. Hans-Peter Grossel, a wonderfully active member of the Kafka community, stumbled upon a need for a MongoDB connector while doing some consulting work. To no one's surprise, he solved it by writing the code for that connector and later open sourcing it. We talk about what it's like to be a sole open source maintainer and how to build community around a project and also how the Kafka MongoDB integration actually works on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome back to Streaming Audio, everyone. I'm your host, Tim Berglund, and I have with me today in the worldwide virtual studio my friend Hans-Peter Grossel. Hans-Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tim. Nice to be here today and have this discussion.
Awesome. So just to tell everybody, I'm recording from my home studio in suburban Denver, Colorado. Where are you located, Hans-Peter?
I'm actually located in Graz, which is in Austria. So pretty much at the center of Europe, if you like.
Awesome. And a beautiful country. I love Austria. I have not been enough, I think is the right way to put it. Now, I think there are probably a fair number of people among our listeners who know who you are. I think you're a pretty prominent person in the Kafka community. But tell us about yourself. Like, what do you do now? How did you get started with Kafka? Give us a little bit of that story.
Okay, it's my pleasure. So, well, what do I do now? I think most of the things that I'm doing these days are somehow related to training and education, which is probably not what people would know me about if they know me at all. So I don't think that I'm that prominent, but thanks for thinking
you are
that
to me.
Way. So yeah, that's good. So and then again, I'm a part-time technical trainer actually at the company here called Netconomy, where we are building large e-commerce solutions for our global customers, basically. Really huge brands are among that as well. So I'm working there as a technical trainer, where I focus on back-end web development, mostly related to Java and Spring. And besides that, I'm working as an independent consultant, where I try to help clients with, let's say, designing and implementing sometimes at least POCs for modern data architectures. And unsurprisingly, very often there is Apache Kafka in one way or another there. And we are most of the time combining that with non-relational operational data stores, if you like. Apart from that, sometimes I do some teaching at a smaller local university as an associate lecturer, also in the field of software engineering. And unlikely, but still, you may have seen one or two conference talks of mine. So time permitting, I try to find some way to spread the word about some cool technologies that I get to work with. And yeah, here and there, I also try to write down some thoughts in blog posts.
That sounds like a delightful professional cocktail. There's a good mix of a lot of things that I personally love in there. So that's a great mix.
Yeah, thanks. What's important is that I really like to do that because it's a lot of different things in detail. But like I said, most of the stuff is still somehow related to training and education, which is, I think, the reason why all of this works. So there are, let's say, enough synergies for that not to fall apart. I mean, for me as a person.
No, that makes sense. And I also just on a personal note, I'm right there with you on that. I've always said if you took me and you put me in a test tube and boiled away everything non-essential, which is, I guess, kind of a weird analogy. But imagine if you did that, what would be left, I think, at the bottom would be a teacher. So I get that. That's a good combination. You left out, I think, open source contributor, and you mentioned non-relational operational data stores. I know you've done a lot of work with Mongo. So tell us how you got involved with MongoDB and why it and not another thing. Before you answer that, I remember in 2010, 2011, I was doing a lot of conference speaking and I had this kind of NoSQL survey talk that was popular among a certain segment of the the developer population at that time, just because it was still fairly new and people trying to get a handle on Cassandra and Mongo and Redis and Neo4j and all these crazy new databases. What's the world like? And people would always ask me, hey, should I use Mongo or should I use Cassandra? Which in retrospect is, you know, a weird question because they're so different. But
yeah,
tell us about your involvement with Mongo. How did that go?
Yeah, so I think if I'm not mistaken, I started to look into MongoDB when it was version 2.6. So I cannot really remember when that was timing wise, but a few years. And the reason was I found it interesting because I wanted to learn about the document oriented data stores, and it was one of the data stores that at least had some visibility already back then, got some traction already in the developer community, and this is how I actually started to look into it. So it really started more out of curiosity and trying to leverage something other than an RDBMS system, which definitely is something that was dominant in everything I did prior to that. So it all started basically as an experiment, as a personal experiment. And then I think I had the luck that I found a small local company who wanted to leverage it at least start with a POC, and I tried to help them. And at the same time, I was learning on along the way, of course. And that was the original involvement. And then I had some after that. We had a POC there. I think they continued, and then I personally had some non MongoDB time again, just because it was the projects were set and structured differently. So I couldn't really leverage it for I think 1 year, and then I came back when 3.something was released. And then I continued again with some other client that tried to leverage, first of all, the document model, and then they also evaluated a few things, and then they settled with MongoDB. So I somehow stick to it because it was the first document-oriented database that I learned about and that I could apply also in practice. And this is, I had no reason, at least not in this, in terms of document-oriented databases, to switch away. So I basically stick to it over the years. And later then, I think we talk about that anyway. I then started to build something that helped with integrating MongoDB as a data store with Kafka as a streaming platform.
Right. And that there's no point in pretending that we don't know what that is. That's fairly obviously going to be a Kafka Connect connector.
Exactly.
That's how you do that. So I don't mean to pretend that we're building up to some dramatic reveal of Hans-Peter wrote a connector. But I do want to talk about, I don't know if you could talk about like the project where that first became obvious. Because if you know a little bit about the platform, you know, okay, here I have a database, I have mm-hmm. Kafka, I want them to talk. We use Connect for that because it keeps us from reinventing about, 73 little wheels that, you need to make that kind of thing work. But what was the, kind of going into that project where that need became necessary? Walk us through that. What was it like as you were working on the POC, providing architectural guidance? What were the things that presented themselves to you that made you think, number one, Kafka and Mongo had to talk?
Yeah.
And number two, that they had to talk in a specific way.
Yeah. So let's start with the first part, which is why was there a need at all to have a connection between Kafka and MongoDB? So the interesting part is that the project was already they were already settled with MongoDB, and what they basically did at that moment is that they ingested their data over a web service directly into MongoDB, and then they had they started to look into different use cases where it made sense that the same data that got ingested can also be leveraged by completely different parts of their landscape. So Given that, the next thought was, well, of course, you could now try to point these other systems or services, if you want to call them microservices, feel free. So they were in need of the data, and then they had basically two integration parts using MongoDB alone. So they could either do polling kind of queries against the database, which is obviously not the best idea. And the other part is that it was I think at pretty much around the time where MongoDB announced to the feature of change streams, so that you can subscribe to changes that are happening in the database and do something with these changes. That would be the second option. And then, well, at that time, I at least had some knowledge built up around Kafka as a streaming platform. And then we thought, well, why not reverse all of this in the sense that the services don't ingest anymore directly into MongoDB, but start to write all the incoming data first into Kafka, and then from there we continue to feed other systems. And at that point in time, well, like you said, it was, if you want, it was during a consulting session with one of these clients that I then said, well, so the question was then how to get data from topics into MongoDB collections. And then I said, well, yeah, you know, there is this great kind of framework called Kafka Connect, and you can actually use it, and you can ship your data from topics into the data store, which is MongoDB in your case. Then, of course, the next question is, okay, is there something that can do that out of the box? And then, yeah, I wasn't actually sure. Then I started to look around a bit. And, of course, there was something available at the time. But it, first of all, it didn't, it was nothing official. So they said, well, yeah, okay, so these are now some projects done by someone pushed to GitHub, which actually we don't know. There was nothing official. And then, well, I said, yeah, so if you have a problem with that, I actually wouldn't have had a huge problem with that. But I said, well, then there is a framework. How hard can that be, right? You can write your own connector, sync connector, that is. And yeah, this you can imagine that these were the words that somehow got me involved, because they, first of all, I think they didn't have the knowledge. And even if they would have had most of the knowledge that they would need, I think they were like most of the time in such projects under high pressure, and they didn't have the resources to do that. And then they said, well, can you do that for us at least? In a way, for a POC that we see, such an architecture could work like it was designed during a workshop. And then, well, what can you say? You can say, you have basically two options. You say no, or, right. and then yeah. Probably it's the end of the consulting session, at least when you look at it from the perspective of working with somebody, at least longer than one or two gigs. And then I said, yes, I can try that. And this is actually how I personally got involved into this whole thing, where I then wrote the first version of the sync connector. I mean, I wouldn't even call it first version. Really, it was just enough to see that what we discussed works in principle and can be a better approach than the others that we dropped for obvious reasons. Yeah, and then it was there. They were to some degree happy, and then it was not so much about them that asked me to do a lot more. It was then really my own interest, and I wanted to improve it, because like I said, there were other connectors out there which could do more or less or at least the same, maybe even a bit more in certain areas, but still looking at the code and everything, I was not convinced that this is something that I personally want to work with for some reasons of for example, not having a reasonable coverage, talking about tests, or not having enough kind of documentation. I was also lacking, looking at the code base, things like extension points. How can you implement different behaviors, different features for the connector? And that were the main reasons why I thought, well, I think I can do better. And I had some good ideas. And then, yeah, I actually by accident, I continued to do that. Mostly because of intrinsic motivation and then I managed to stick to it for some reason, and it evolved over time, became better and better, and then
went on to even bigger things that we'll talk about. I want to say your story of that meeting with that client reminds me of a UPS commercial that aired in the US maybe like 15 years ago or so, but there were these two consultants sitting in front of a CEO and, you know, giving him their conclusions about how he should modernize his supply chains and, you know, do all this stuff and using some nice abstract business language. And the CEO is very pleased with this. He goes, "Great, do it." And they look at him like all confused. They go, "Wait, we don't do the things we recommend. We only recommend them."
Yeah, exactly.
And then at the end of the commercial, they're going down the elevator and one says, "You believe that guy?" So, right, as a consultant, which you have been and which you are, you know, that's less of an option, right? Of course, you said yes, and we're all glad you did. But I want to talk about, you said that there were connectors out there and like the specifics don't matter, but you weren't happy with them. You just, it was your judgment that they were not a good way to proceed. And this is an important thing about Connect. It's an important thing about open source, and the kind of ecosystem that Connect fosters brings this to light in an important way. So let me get my thoughts out and tell me what you think. So Connect, if you're listening and you're brand new to the Kafka ecosystem, it's a data integration framework. It's a process that runs external to Kafka brokers. From the standpoint of the Kafka cluster, it's a client like a producer or a consumer. And you have these pluggable connectors that are jar files at the most concrete level. And you configure them and they come to life and they read data from some other system or read from Kafka and write to some other system. So it's this integration framework. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously enough, that creates an ecosystem of connectors. And there are closed source connectors, there are commercial connectors, there are open source connectors, there are all kinds of connectors. And among the open source ones, like you can go search on GitHub, I want to connect to, you know, you wanted to connect to Mongo and you found a few options. And I always make this point that it's the whole point of using Connect is that you don't write that integration code yourself. You use a connector because it's the same integration code everybody else is going to write. And it's not adding value to you or your company to do that yourself. It's not differentiated, right? But when there are all these open source options, this is, you know, we used to talk a lot early in the 2000s, late in the 90s about open source being free as in speech or free as in beer.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes some open source projects, and I think long tail connectors in particular, are free as in puppy. And speaking as a man whose family just got a puppy a couple months ago, puppies are a lot of work, right? You gotta feed them more often. You gotta clean up after them. They wake up in the middle of the night. They bark, chew things they're not supposed to chew, you know, which is a lot like a long tail connector that somebody wrote and it did what they needed. And maybe it's still doing what they need, but they're not maintaining it. And it doesn't have any kind of community around it. It's just this repo out there.
Yeah.
And some of those are like, you do want to adopt the puppy. It's worthwhile to bring it home and housebreak it and give it obedience training. And it'll be, you know, part of the family for a long time. But sometimes that's not what you want. And so you got to be careful and realize that you're adopting a puppy when you take one of those on. You didn't.
Yeah, I feel with you. I feel with you totally, but I cannot really relate personally, because luckily I have no such thing as a puppy at home. That's the good part of it.
Lucy is a good girl. I should be on record. I'll tweet a picture of her, or put a picture of her in the show notes when we publish this, just so she can have.
Absolutely. I will give you at least one like, if not a retweet.
Okay, thank you, sir. So anyway, I think you encountered the free as in puppy phenomenon for open source Mongo connectors, and mm-hmm. that's a thing to be aware of. And you went on the journey of writing your own, and then that in that engagement, it actually got put into production. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. So it got put into production, not by me directly. So of course, I'm not running anything on that connector in production on my own, but there were two early adopters. There were two early adopters, actually one coming from, I mean, both these early adopters, if you want, were are mentioned in the README, so they are in the talks. So it's actually two companies, one which is in Germany, and another one which is surprisingly from the US. So they are listed there, and they were quite happy. I think that, again, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was somewhere at around 1 year after I started it or something like that. So yeah, so then there were real customers, if you want, for this connector. And then, yeah, they got in touch, they discussed a few things, they of course wanted to help improve it, in the sense that they suggested some features that could get implemented, actually some of which did. So starting from that point on, I think it gained at least some traction in its, if you want, in its own niche. And yeah, then I think I then tried to get in touch with you guys and asked if it could be. So back then it was not even the hub where you can find this curated list, a really nice one about all the most of the popular connectors out there. It was just at the connectors page back then, and there it got listed. So at least people could easily find it from your web page for that. And then later you released the hub, and then I again got in touch and wanted to have it listed on the hub also because I was convinced, knowing from the other two companies, that it works out quite well in production. So I thought, well, everything that I can do to make it more visible might be of help to others, and I think that putting it on the hub was actually the next step in terms of getting more visibility for this still very, very small side project of mine.
Yeah. So what was it like getting it listed on Connect Hub? Walk us through that process from the standpoint of open source maintainer.
So the first time I got it to the hub, I think it was there was no build plugin or something which you provided later. So or it was in a very early version. I got in touch with one of the maintainers or one of the responsibles from your side. I think it was Chris, and he basically helped me also to understand and have an easy time to just modify the build a bit, so that I get a package structure, or actually an archive structure, that I then sent basically manually to you, and you put it on the hub. So this was the very first time it got listed there, and it required some manual effort, but it was very straightforward after all, and you were very first of all cooperative in helping along this process, so it was pretty smooth to get it there, and people could find it and use it. So I think from that perspective of getting it there, there's nothing to complain about.
Nice, nice, good. I'm glad, and I know you're on our podcast, and you're a gentleman, and you might not complain if there were, but it's still good to hear that from the outside that process is smooth, and that's exactly how I understand it to be. So,
yeah,
cool. And it is absolutely on Connect Hub. But what? And the story from there are two interesting things that happened or that I would like to dig into. And one is, going back to this free as in puppy, at some point when you're maintaining, as a one person show, an open source project, it's like a puppy as a service, you know, everybody gets to come pet it and enjoy its cuteness, but they aren't the ones cleaning up after it or training it or having it bark in the middle of the night or anything like that. You are the sole maintainer of the thing. And, you know, people have expectations. So what was that like as it became popular? I'm assuming there was more adoption and, what's it like? What was it like for you to be a one person show maintaining a project like that?
Yeah, I think you got a very, very important point here that this is, let's say that if you look at it from over a longer perspective, I think it's a lot of ups and downs, honestly. So it's, of course, there are, let's say, some rewarding aspects to it, being that the one man show, the one, let's say, writer and contributor to the project code-wise. This is so you know that every time you do something, you were the one who made something possible, or you were the one who could help someone. This is the good part of it. Then there are, let's say, not so nice parts of it, like people opening, let's say, issues in a non-polite way, that can happen, or people who are
then
people who are like only informing you what's missing, like never really taking not at least two or three words to thank you what's there and what's working, but only, you know, nitpicking about the things that they would like to see and the things that are probably not working as they think they should. That's the hard part, because you have no one, literally no one, who you can, let's say, who you can discuss that with, who you can share these feelings with. So again, emotionally, I think there's a lot of ups and downs involved in that. And I think that the I think I was lucky to one degree, because, like I said, that after some time, I think again a year or so, there were customers, which is like some very important, let's say, milestone from that perspective of getting something back, like a reward, if you want. It of course, this has nothing to do with money. But still, it's something where you are happy about, and where and these are the moments, I guess, that you need at least from time to time to be able to stick to it and to be able to work on it and continue that project. I think if this is really vital, if you never get any kind of reward in what form or in any form, again, I'm not talking about money here, then you can get frustrated over time. I think you might even suffer from, I don't know, maybe even burnout kind of symptoms. I don't know. I think I was lucky that I didn't experience it in that way. But yeah, I think that can happen easily when you are doing all of that on your own. Another thing is that people, even if documentation is there, obviously don't like to read this documentation. So on the one hand, we all know that people don't, or developers sometimes are not particularly thankful if they should write documentation. But even if you do, and even if you do that in your free time and you try to have some kind of reasonable documentation, people are sometimes not reading it. And then you basically what happens is that you get issues which are more questions or invalid ones that could be easily solved by themselves by spending 5 minutes in the README or something like that. This is also something that can, that to some degree it's funny, but again, it's a lot of personal attitude, how you see such events. If you find it funny, if you try to be helpful even in that situations, or if you see that as another frustrating moment. I guess what's important is to not to let it into your head too much what happens on the issue tab in your project. That's important. I think you should find a way to keep some distance there.
Yeah. No, all that is great. And I really wanted to talk about this because this is a side of open source that we don't always think about. Like if you haven't been a maintainer, this is not going to occur to you. And you know, we have the well-known problem of sometimes people treat open source projects like public utilities, you know, like this is, it's free. Therefore I have a right to it. Therefore I have a right to influence its backlog and demand fixes and, you know, communicate with the maintainer in a brusque, matter-of-fact, or even rude tone. Like that happens. And it kind of depends on the maintainer's personality. You know, there are people who just don't care and are going to be unaffected by that. You're not that kind of guy. I happen to know I'm not that kind of guy. You know, that kind of thing is very taxing on me. So it's just a good reminder that if you use a small open source project that has one or few maintainers, it's a good idea to remember that, like, you are receiving the gift of that person's time. Like you said, you had a motivation. You were trying to solve a problem for a client, and your continued investment in it, you know, maybe you're motivated by, you know, this is marketing for future consulting or something. You know, there's some angle that you have, but still, you know, the user who's not contributing is you are giving that person a gift of your time, and you should treat open source maintainers like people who are giving you a gift. Now, big projects that have big companies behind them, I think, you know, everybody still has an obligation to be polite and to generally love their neighbor. But the economics of that are different if you're dealing with something large. But a small thing the Mongo connector, you know, there's one guy. Look, do a git blame on any file you want. You see one name behind all those commits. And you should treat the person like somebody who gave you something. And, you know, you can report bugs, you can ask questions, you can have opinions, but do it in a polite way. And if you're so inclined, you know, it would be nice to occasionally file an issue that just says, hey, this worked and it's wonderful. And they know that issue will get closed. But there are, again, just depends on who the maintainer is. There are people who thrive on positive feedback. And you might consider that if you're a beneficiary of a project like this to do that. Be nice to open source contributors.
Yes, that's definitely a plus, and it helps keeping motivation high.
Right. You'll keep getting the thing that you like, and they won't go away and stop doing it, because chances are they probably have, if there's somebody who could write a MongoDB connector, they probably have relatively high value opportunity costs that they could fall back to with their time and go do instead of doing that thing.
Yeah, and actually what's also interesting is the fact that we always said from the beginning that we are now discussing this story that there was nothing official. And actually that was also, let's say, a limiting factor to some degree for myself, because I always thought, is it even worth putting some effort into implementing yet another feature, because the day has to come where something official will get announced and will get released, and then we all know that it's basically means the end of a one-man show project, most likely, because you can never really be competitive as soon as some big company starts to invest in that and allocate resources for that. And that was something that I was personally struggling with a bit, at least sometimes along the way. Does it make sense to continue? Because I'm sure that something will come in the next 1 or 2 months. And then for quite some time, surprisingly for quite some time, nothing came. So I was lucky that let's say the project lived on, even if I was still or still am today for this community project that, if you wanted, the only one maintainer.
Cool. What in the process of building it, I think we've been talking about, you know, frankly, the personal side of writing open source. Were there any interesting technical hurdles in the Connect API or in Mongo, just making it work? From 10,000 feet, database sync connector, once you know what Connect is, and if you know what a database is, it's very easy to understand what it does, but the devil's in the details. And were there any details that were particularly devilish?
Actually, it was relatively smooth, but I have to say that that was definitely what was very, very helpful to get started was the I'm not sure if it still exists in the same form, but back then you published this kind of Connect developer guide or guideline. I think this was a PDF, basically about, I don't know if I remember correctly, something like 10 to 15 pages, which first of all, explained how you should approach writing a new connector. So that was very helpful to understand how to get started quickly. Then again, I think another aspect is that when you really implement the sync connector part, so getting data out of Kafka into some data store, I think honestly in more or less all cases, writing sync connectors is probably easier by a large part than writing source connectors for several reasons. It's just much easier to write the sync than a source. This was also, I think, one of the reasons why this one man side project of mine never really tried to provide a source connector. First of all, there has been a very good one out there already, baked by Red Hat. We all know this great project, this family of connectors called Debezium. It just didn't make any sense for me to try and write the harder part, which is definitely the source connector. So I stick to the sync side, and then, I mean, talking about any devil is in the details kind of moments, I think there weren't many, honestly, at least nothing that I can remember now from the top of my head where I was really frustrated. So working with the Connect API and the framework is really straightforward. What the challenges are, again, there in the sense that you need to find a way, let's say, do you want to support upsert semantics towards the sync? Do you want to, how do you want to commit consumed offsets? But that's most of the time that's some decisions that you take and you decide to go this or that way, and you can change that and enhance that later on as you go. And actually that is what I did. So first of all, I started with just bringing data over there with upsert semantics and nothing else. And that was a good starting point. And later I added things like native support for Debezium's change data capture format so that you can leverage the sync connector together with Debezium source and basically replicate MongoDB instances over Kafka, at least from a data perspective. That is something that I added later, which again, just needs some time but it's not so challenging. So honestly, most of the things are absolutely not rocket science. All the heavy lifting, seriously, is done by Connect under the covers, and that's a good thing because, yeah, you have really, really great distributed systems engineers, and they know how to do that in a reliable and distributed way. So yeah, again, as a Connect implementer, it's pretty smooth.
Cool. That is good to hear, because that again is that's my view of Connect, and this is how I always make the case for Connect when I'm explaining the platform to people. Because some people will actually ask me, "Hey, why wouldn't I just write that on my own? Why use a framework?" And I'm like, "You haven't been doing this for very long, have you?" Because it's a deceptively simple problem, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just gonna subscribe to a topic, consume messages from it, write them to a Mongo collection. Come on, that takes me 2 hours to write that code. And you think that, but then scaling that connector, fault tolerance, every other of the 308 corner cases that are going to present themselves to you are actually a lot of work. And having the framework handle all of, well, I mean, like I said before, that the purpose of a connector is that it is non-differentiated code. Your syncing of Kafka data into Mongo is exactly the same as everybody else's syncing of Kafka data into Mongo. So you shouldn't write that. But then you zoom into you, and here you have Hans Peter writing connector code so that it can be written once and everybody can use that undifferentiated code. Mm. Well, from your standpoint as the connector writer, fault tolerance, scalability, offset syncing, all of that stuff, the distributed systems and framework elements of Kafka Connect itself, that's your undifferentiated code that would be foolish for you to write along with every other connector author. So Connect is in place to be that. And it's nice to hear, you know, the first person report of a connector writer who says, yep, that stuff actually works the way it's supposed to.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because we all think it does, and it's nice to know that it really does. Cool. Now, and things happened from there. It got some attention, and eventually the folks at Mongo came to be aware of it. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so that was funny. Like I said, I had here and there. I always thought, well, something must be done in that regard from the official side. Like I was really, really surprised not to see that addressed by them. On the other hand, you could say, well, there was something in that case, my project, which was obviously good enough for some time, even for some of the customers to use, most likely. So some of which I definitely do not know about, because not everyone, like I said, got in touch with me. Some were just using it. So, and then they approached me. I think it was in late 2018, so December 2018 or something. And then they actually got in touch first by email, then. We set up a first webcast. And then I was really, really happy that, first of all, they already knew a lot about the project. They were also happy about the way it was done. I mean, how the code basically was designed, leveraging the framework. So it was like I said, stuff that's not there in some other connectors were considered when I wrote it, like extensibility, customizability, and stuff like that. A lot of things regarding configuration was there already, and they knew their test coverage was good, documentation was there. So basically, yeah, they were happy, and they were then asking if we can cooperate somehow, because they were wondering how they actually want to address that topic on their own. The time was there for them to start doing something about not having something official in their product and services list. And this is how it all started. Then we had a few more meetings with some engineers, and then we basically discussed how we can proceed in making the code base and changing it towards the official connector. Of course, a lot was done then from their side with regard to repackaging, making sure there are like coding guidelines, static analysis checks and stuff like that. So everything that a more professional project would need anyway. They have applied that, they have done that, but it was very, very quickly done. Like I said, they were happy with how the code looked back then in the community repo of mine. And yeah, it was pretty smooth and they were really, really cooperative. And I think it was honestly a clear win-win situation also for myself, because I knew, and I think this is not something that happens often, or let's say from my own perspective, I think this is something that happens probably once in a lifetime, that somebody comes along and really is happy about a side project of yours and wants to or is convinced and confident that it is it makes sense to leverage that code instead of starting to write something from scratch on their own. And this is, like I said, one of these really, really rewarding moments that I was just lucky to have experienced, because I think a lot of people are doing much, much better work than I did in different areas and never were lucky enough that somebody came along and actually wanted that the code base lives on in one way or another. So a lot of emotions, but definitely everything was positive. So I never felt bad about anything that happened since we got in touch and since we cooperated on that.
Wonderful. And that really is a great story. I mean, that's you did some work for a consulting project, you invested a lot of yourself into it, and now it's the sync connector. You know, we had the source connector. Like you said, that's a different ball of wax, and that's Debezium is what people usually use for that. And now this is the official way to get data from Kafka into Mongo.
Exactly.
Which is super. And I think it's a great contribution. What's next for you? Is there anything you can talk about that you're working on now or excited about in the near future?
Oh yeah. So there's a lot. So the problem is my backlog is really huge, my personal one. So I have to find some time during my vacation to think about it, how I want to proceed. I mean, there's different things I have. On the one hand, I'm thinking about new features for the connector, obviously features that I would want to contribute to the official one right now. Maybe trying how they work and if they make sense in my community repo before, and then maybe contributing this stuff to the official connector. That is one thing in that regard. On the other hand, I want to have some topics in mind with regard to leveraging Kafka Streams together with Connect for doing certain things like implementing certain data integration patterns where you would probably need Kafka Streams or combine that with KSQL, because it's doing things that cannot or should not be done in that way with Kafka Connect. Then I have some ideas about writing blog posts. I wrote a few of them over the last couple of months, but I have a few more ideas that I want to externalize, let's put it like that. And maybe I manage to find some time to write some blog posts. So yeah, so basically a lot of stuff that needs prioritization. But maybe to your delight, some of the things, or most of the things actually are related to Kafka.
Well, that does indeed make me happy. My guest today has been Hans-Peter Grassel. Hans-Peter, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Really, Tim, thanks for having me. And yeah, hope to hear you soon.
Hey, you know what you get for listening to the end? A Kafka Summit discount code. Kafka Summit is coming up on September 30th and October 1st in downtown San Francisco. And you can get 30% off if you go to kafka-summit.org and use the discount code AUDIO19 during checkout. Just enter AUDIO19 while registering at kafka-summit.org, and that 30% off is all yours. I'd love to see you there. But hey, I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in our community Slack. There's a Slack sign-up link in the show notes if you want to register there. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast, which is a good thing. Thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.